Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jacob Kanzler, Jack Spencer, Mike Malott, and our special guest this week, Ari Adler, who is former spokesperson for all three legs of the stool here in Lansing with the Senate Majority Leader, House Speaker, and Governor over a period of some 15, 20 years here in this town. And I brought you in here, Ari, because I wanted to talk a bit about where we are going to go forward now with negotiations with the governor and the legislative leaders on a budget and presumably some road funding. And I think if we could just go back to the Wayback Machine to 2003, when you were the spokesperson for Ken Sikkema, we were starting on this territory, and we're starting on this journey of a Republican-led legislature dealing with a Democratic governor, and things actually went okay. I mean, it wasn't like the Bishop Granholm Dillon years where we were had to threaten shutdowns. They actually kind of worked together, if my memory served right.
Yeah, they did. And, you know, Ken Sikkema was a pragmatist, right? I mean, so he had his philosophies that he was going to try to support, but he was one of those people that you are guided by your principles, but you're not controlled by them. So when you need to make a deal with somebody or you move forward, whether it was, you know, Bob Emerson was the Senate Minority Leader at the time, and they used to butt heads publicly, but privately they would figure out how to get things done, and then they would work with Governor Granholm and try to figure it out. It wasn't always easy. But you tried to do it.
So what do you see happening with this triumvirate?
You know, part of the issue right now is, I mean, we've been dealing with road funding in this state forever. The idea that you're going to tie some road funding solution to the budget just means you're going to slow the budget down that much more. And that's going to be a concern. It's why we don't have a budget. I mean, when I was with Governor Snyder, we did 8 budgets in a row. We were done by this time. We had them signed or ready to be signed at this time of the year, and they're just starting their negotiations now. So that's going to be a problem going forward.
Are we at risk of a shutdown, Jack?
Oh, it's way too early to talk about that. I think it's way too early. And I see one of the ways that they could do this, depending on how they negotiate it. Are they going to go back at some point and do one, you know, in departmental budget at a time? That gives you a lot more leeway for something in the middle where, okay, we can do this, we can do pieces of it as we get toward the end and have, and continue, and cut down what we have to work on. We've gotten used to these big omnibus bills, but I think that's an option. As we found out last week, the Senate is keeping that option open, and I think that's one of the things we can watch for. But to me, being the cynic that I am, the fact that they're getting along so well with the governor and so on and so forth, which I do think is vital, that has as much to do with them giving each other cover at some point and being able to say, okay, we can do this or that in a transportation budget that will cover what the governor wants to a certain extent. Well, we, you know, so she can say, okay, we made this deal. I did get more added to the transportation budget, and then finish things off and then finish off the whole transportation deal, whatever it is they're doing later. To me, that's what the significance is of them working together, is actually understanding what each other needs.
Part of the reason I asked about the shutdown and maybe you're right that this is too early to talk about this, but if they are going to do some type of roads package along with the budget, then do they have to talk about revenue increases? And if they're doing revenue increases, you still have to get 56 and 20 votes in the House and the Senate. And are those members in the House and in the Senate, how hard is it going to be to get them to vote yes on a revenue increase? That's not where their mind seems to be right now. They've just gotten done passing budgets without any revenue increases. And so they see that, in their mind at least, that you can balance a budget and put more money to roads without raising taxes. So if all of a sudden now you're putting a tax increase on the table, whether it's an increased gas tax or whatever it is, an expansion of sales tax on services or whatever they end up doing, what kind of pressure do you have to put on those members in order to get them to vote yes on a tax increase? And will the threat of a calendar, October 1, September 30, be that push to get them there? That's why I bring up that question.
Well, it's more than just the revenue increase. You've got to remember now you have, you know, Republican legislature and a Democrat governor. So when Rick Snyder was in, we had difficulty with Republicans in the legislature talking anything about revenue increases of any kind. So if they had difficulty with a Republican governor, are they going to do a revenue increase with a Democrat governor who can then take credit for getting things done? So not only are they raising revenue or taxes, however you want to look at it, but they're also giving an opportunity for the governor of another party to take credit for getting things done. Makes it more complicated because of the politics.
And I just don't see a lot of fast movement over here right now with the talking about negotiations with the governor and the legislature. The House and the Senate, neither of them have a road plan right now. They have pieces of what they want to do, but they don't have a long-term road plan to even talk about yet. So they can negotiate, I suppose, Jacob, but what are they? What's the governor's office negotiating with the House and the Senate on as it relates to roads?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I guess you have to wonder how steadfast is the governor going to hold to her commitment of not signing a budget with additional funding and what that additional funding looks like. Does she mean the full extent of her gas tax increase? Or is it to the extent that the House Republicans have already passed a plan that puts, you know, a couple hundred million more dollars into roads? One of the things that's going to be interesting is if Republicans pass a budget that puts a little bit more towards roads that doesn't raise taxes, that's kind of what they're looking for. But is there political fallout for not getting the job done? That seems to be the governor's impetus for putting out such a, what some people think is a crazy proposal, a 45-cent gas tax. But she's trying to make the claim that this will solve the problem once and for all. And I wonder what kind of political weight does that carry versus not raising taxes, but potential of still seeing potholes in a few years.
Mike, I want to talk to you, too, about how much more difficult is it going to be to get a budget done with a revenue increase and some type of road funding increase involved than it was no-fault insurance. Because when we had no-fault insurance, now, obviously, that's been an issue that's been going on for 30-some years, but you had a critical mass of Republicans who wanted to get that done after what they heard on the campaign trail and at the doors. So you had Republicans who were hell-bent on getting something done. As far as road funding goes, that's not their issue. And so now they have to basically do what is the governor's top issue, and how excited are they to be pushing a green button to get this done? They're going to need House and Senate Democrats to come to the table and say, yeah, hell yeah, we'll be there for you on this revenue increase.
With no fault, and I think, Kyle, it was your story that best encapsulated it, the Republicans had votes to move the bill, and they were losing votes. I don't think that's necessarily the case with road funding. I don't think we have an agreement yet as to where we're going. In fact, I think what Republicans have to show, and probably Democrats too, is they have to show that they fought the good fight. Mm-hmm. Republicans don't want to increase taxes, and if they could do it without increasing taxes, they'd do it. The money's not there. They had 8 years of Republican control and couldn't find the pot of gold at the end of the budget rainbow. So if we want to fix the roads, there probably is need for a revenue enhancement. But Republicans have to show that they're going to only do this as a last resort. They're going to fight the good fight. So I think that's the key, is you're going to see the battle fought hard to the last man before we decide what we're doing.
Part of the problem, though, too, is where's the public in all of this, right? And are they ever going to see the roads to where they want them? I mean, even with the governor's, as Jacob said, sort of the crazy 45 cents, if you were to max out on that, you're still not going to fix all the local roads. I mean, that's primarily going towards state roads, right? And so people are going to see the interstates get better, and they're going to see the state highways get better. But your local road that you're driving across, whether it's in your subdivision or in your town, is not going to get that kind of improvement. So no matter what, people are always going to be mad. I mean, I worked for years in the Department of Transportation. People are always mad about the roads. Either they're in crappy shape or you're fixing them and now you're in their way, right? When they're trying to get to work or something. So the public's never really satisfied about the roads. And I think that's going to be an issue too, is what do they get out of it? If they're going to jump off the cliff and go for some sort of a tax increase, what's the payback in terms of, are people going to see enough work?
Yeah, is there going to be an incentive to vote yes on a tax increase? Because, Jack, you've seen things in this town long enough that it is hard to get Republicans to vote yes on any type of tax increase, particularly one that's not their idea to begin with.
Well, yeah, it's going to be difficult to do. But, I mean, like that's why I've been a little bit defending the governor on her 45 cent, because the way I'm looking at it is what Ari just said. Look, 3 years from now, whatever they do, 3 years from now, the road still won't be the way people are satisfied with it. And she can say, see, I asked for 45 cents. You know, she that looks better and better, you know, when the roads aren't good 3 years from now. I still think that the idea that she is going to get this before, you know, as part of the budget, when the legislature is flat out saying, nah, if we do this at the end of October, it's okay. If we do this on Thanksgiving, it's okay. Tells me that the real question is sort of what Jacob talked about. How do you cover each other so the governor can accept a budget? So you got to do something in there that gives her an out to accept whatever budget they pass by October 1st and still gives them the time to work on the bigger picture of the transportation thing afterward. I think that's really what the game's going to be.
And if you do it as part, this is the difficulty that I have when you do something large like a road program like this and you do it as part of the budget and you tie it that closely, what's your trade-off? So what are you doing in the budget for the Republicans to be able to scale back somewhere else? Mm. And then what other constituencies are affected by that and are they willing to do that?
Well, maybe that's why the governor wants to do this as part of the budget, because there can be that expands the universe of the trade-offs that she can give the Republicans in exchange for the tax increase.
Yeah, but then do you end up watering down everything? Like, you know, you don't get all of the road funding that you were looking for, but plus you're cutting back in the budget somewhere else, so somebody's going to be affected by that. And it's, you know, people always want to cut back budgets until it affects them, and then that budget needs to stay put. We've had that. I mean, when Ken Sikkema was majority leader all those years ago, we used to have that problem. So things don't change.
All right. So then the next subject I want to bring up is the Enbridge controversy with the governor and Line 5 and the Attorney General, Dana Nessel. The question I want to put on the table is it all just smoke? This hubbub about whether we're going to actually shut down Line 5. And the question I want to put out there along with that is it even possible for the state to shut down Line 5? I'll go ahead and just put that on there. When we haven't had another instance where a state has been able to shut down a pipeline that crosses multiple states and goes into ultimately another country, can the state of Michigan actually shut this down? And is all this talk about negotiations and whether we're going to go to court and whatever going to all be for naught? Because in the end, Enbridge is going to be able to build its tunnel under a prior agreement with the governor, and the state is not going to be able to shut it down, and it's all going to just end up being what Enbridge has agreed to under the Snyder administration.
I'm guessing the answer you're looking for is yes.
No, I want your opinion. I basically gave you my opinion. If you got a conflicting one, please share.
So I'm with you on that, in that we've seen these studies, and you know, Enbridge has put forth a case for the tunnel, as did the prior administration. So you would think that Enbridge has the leverage, but they're being very careful. They're waging a PR campaign to get the public on their side. Is it possible for the state to shut it down? I mean, I know some people think so, but we've had 6 months of two Democrats in control of the AG and the governor's office who had at one point. You know, said they wanted to decommission Line 5, and we haven't seen that yet. So I think that lends credence to what you're saying, is that can the state actually do something? I'd like to see.
It would seem to me that the best chance that the Attorney General has to doing something is to muck up the whole tunnel and trying to argue that the legislation that was passed during lame duck violated the one subject rule in regards to how a law is passed. And their best shot, Ari, would be to screw up the actual building of the tunnel and the commission that created it. But then what do you have? Then you've screwed up the whole mechanism by which Enbridge is actually getting the pipe out of the water. And the end result would be that Enbridge's pipe is still in the water. And then now they have no exit strategy.
Yeah, I mean, you commented earlier that, you know, does Enbridge just push ahead and go under the old agreement they had with Governor Snyder and build the tunnel? The worst case scenario to me is it all gets screwed up and they just leave things status quo. If you can't shut down Line 5, and there's a lot of question about whether you can do that legally or not, or if you're going to, who's going to take on a $1 billion corporation with state tax dollars, right? How do you sustain that when you're looking at legal fees and court costs and everything else? So worst case scenario is they completely screw up what we had set in place, and then you end up with the pipeline continuing to sit on the bottom of the straits, which is what everybody has been trying to stop. and you're not going to get anywhere if you do that.
The way I look at it, I think Nestle and the governor have to play to their base to a certain extent. Nestle makes it somewhat easier for the governor because she can go whole hog and the governor can look more moderate by comparison. And they have to be able to, when they lose eventually, when this thing either stays where it is now, which is even worse for them because 6 years down the line, if this thing is still there, and then something happens, half of the blame, at least, if not more, is going to go to the people that blocked the tunnel. So they have a time constraint. It's not an immediate time restraint, but a long-term time restraint. And I think that basically they have to play to their base and they have to be able to turn to their base and say, we did everything we could. And look at the way the courts are, blah, 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 whatever. But I do not see how they have a real end game where they win and shut down the pipe unless suddenly, out of nowhere, I actually hear a viable alternative coming from that side. And they, so far, if they've had one, I haven't heard it.
I think the key point here is what's the end game. I can think of no, I mean, I'm not an engineer and I'm not a pipeline expert, but I can think of no safer way to get oil and gas across that strait, and oil and gas is going to cross that strait somehow, some way. I can think of no better way than to put it in a tunnel 100 feet underneath the lake bed. The sooner that happens, the better. It's almost bulletproof. You could, again, I'm not an engineer, but I think you could pretty much sink a freighter on top of that tunnel and not have it affect the pipeline if it's 100 feet underneath the lake bed. So the sooner we can get it there, the better. Delaying that process only makes us susceptible longer.
Yeah, I think Jack is spot on here. I think, you know, the governor and the attorney general can put up a fight as long as possible, but, you know, if a court comes back and says that the prior agreements are valid and that it's challenged all the way to the final stop, what else can you do? I mean, at that point, you're kind of, there's no way you can legally stop this tunnel thing. So yes, I think they can, you know, put up a fight as much as possible, and we've arranged it so far, but Enbridge will probably move forward and we'll have the legal backing to do so.
So why do we keep talking about this? Why is this continuously being brought up? And I think that from the environmental standpoint, this is always been the conversation about oil pipelines in general. And Mike, earlier today, you were showing us the map of all the oil pipelines that there are in the United States. And there's hundreds and hundreds of miles of them all over the place, all over Michigan, all over the country. And I think that the focus on Line 5 is to just put a visual into the minds of the public about the fact that we have oil pipelines and what happens if they burst. And trying to get people away from thinking about oil as the future and that there are other alternatives out there that we should all be thinking about and pushing. That this is just a much broader conversation than Line 5. This is a conversation about clean energy in general. And we should all be moving toward that. And if Line 5 is the focus that makes us think about it that way, then that's the way that we're going to go about and doing it. That's what I think is the long-term goal here, is to get pipelines in general to be a dinosaur and that we all think of things in terms of alternative energy.
I think that's wonderful, and I think we should push towards the you know, green energy and the clean energy of the future. But how are you going to get to work tomorrow? Because you're still running an internal combustion engine in your car. How are you going to get to work next week? So there has to be a phase out of oil and gas. Sorry, that's just reality.
I thought you were going to ride your bike to work tomorrow. The way your cars have been operating, Mike, I thought the bike was going to be the next step.
It might be.
Well, and Mike's right, though. I mean, so if the whole green energy thing is where we're headed eventually, it's going to take a long time to get there. And in the meantime, this pipeline is sitting in the water in the Straits of Mackinac, and you can't leave it there. I mean, everybody seems to agree we need to get it out of there. The question is, you shut it down completely, which you can't do because you're going to cut off the UP, or do you bury it somehow, which seems to be the best engineering answer? And that's going to take time. I mean, when we set up the original proposal, one of the original arguments that people had against us was said it could take up to 10 years to get it done. Well, yeah, it could if you count all the engineering work that has to be done and then the actual construction. So as soon as Governor Whitmer and AG Nestle just came in, they immediately delayed it even further. So that kind of is an interesting argument to make, that we were taking too long to get it out of the water, and yet now it's being delayed even further.
They've been going after these pipelines for a long time. I don't remember it that way. I remember them taking 11 years saying that the Great Lakes were drying up. And I remember them saying, you know, this is a water quantity problem, et cetera, for 11 years. And it's there. I wrote about it before saying, we don't have a water quantity problem. We have a water, and you're ignoring the water quality. Basically, the idea that this is all real well thought out and it's not what's hot right now, what gets the most clicks right now, I don't entirely agree that it's all about well thought out policy. I think there's a tendency, just like all politicians and everything else, groups go for what the hot issue is, and this is the hot issue in Michigan right now.
Goodness gracious. Does somebody give you the cynic hat somewhere? Will somebody send Jack a hat that just says cynic on it, and he's going to have to wear it during every single podcast?
I mean, I agree with Jack somewhat, though, because we're in this era now of what I would call Facebook activism. And it's all about what's going to get clicks or what's going to get everybody riled up at that moment, and how many likes can you get on Facebook, and how many people can you share something with. And then, you know, you protest on Facebook, and then you go back to watching your cat videos and you feel like you did something.
Yeah. I know. I mean, what's easier to rally around? Shut down Line 5 or let's construct an underground tunnel to protect the Great Lakes and also ensure our energy infrastructure? One of those, only one of those fits on a poster.
Groups have been doing this for years. I mean, if it's not been the internet or Facebook, it's been the Clean Water Action people going door to door, and or postcards or mailers or people handing out flyers on street corners. I mean, this is just the new modern way to connect with people and get them to care about your issue. The bottom line for me is that this Line 5 issue is being used as the rallying cry for a much larger subject, which is dirty coal, oil, energy that environmental groups are just trying to phase us out of, and Line 5 is just emblematic of that debate. All right, thanks everybody here for the conversation. Let's switch over to the interview portion of the podcast with House Minority Leader Christine Gray. Joining us now for the podcast is the House Minority Leader, Christine Gregg. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. Appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for asking me.
All right. Well, the big question we want to talk about is your road funding plan that the House Democrats have laid out. We just want to make it clear here. Are you guys saying no to a gas tax since you have this thing out there?
No, and I think one misconception is it's not a plan. These are individual bills. These are different ideas for raising revenue. If Republicans continue to say they're not going to support 45 cents, well, what are some other ideas for generating revenue that we could offer up at the table during the negotiations?
And so you don't see this as competition to Gretchen Whitmer's plan. Is that correct?
This is how to get to $2.5 billion. We've got to get to that. And that's, the governor has said she's open to other ideas to get to $2.5 billion as long as it's dedicated, it's new revenue and it's dedicated to the roads. And that's what these ideas do.
So if not a gas tax, then we could talk about taxing heavy trucks, or we could talk about raising the corporate income tax. What kind of response have you gotten since this got rolled out?
Actually, really positive response, and part of that is because these ideas actually came from voters and residents across the state. We heard loud and clear when we had our two-week break. We pushed it out during our coffees and town halls. We had a website survey. And first what we asked are, what are your priorities for the state to work on? And it was clear. It was roads and schools and clean water. Those were the top three priorities. And then we said, well, okay, if you agree that those are priorities, how do we generate revenue to make sure that we meet those needs? And we heard that they wanted shared responsibility. They're willing to pay more at the pump, but they also want to make sure that business is stepping up and that those parties that are actually damaging our roads the most are doing some more too. And that's where the heavy trucks came in, and the tolls.
There's been talks about heavy trucks before and the kind of pounding that they put on the roads. Did you ever think you'd be on kind of the same page as the Mackinac Center? They've also kind of flagged heavy trucks as being a problem.
Yeah, that kind of surprised me. But when you think about it, it's common sense, right? And again, that's why it came up from so many people across the state, is that, you know, we see... I've had two windshield cracked in the last 12 months, and I know those were things flying up from trucks as well, too. So there's a lot of damage, not just on the roads, but on the drivers that go near the trucks as well.
So the Mackinac Center, in its report last fall, said that heavy trucks were paying 10 cents a mile to use the roads. I looked this up this morning, so I remember. but they were doing 60 cents worth of damage. Does your package actually apply it so that that's going to be comparable to what the damage that they're doing?
So our bill says we're going to increase it by 6 cents a mile. So I'm 1/10 of what the Mackinac Center was saying, evidently. But if you, based on the information that we had, when I was trying to do a calculation of raising up even 40 more cents for that, that was basically generating all of $2.5 billion. So I'm not really sure where the Mackinac note got their numbers from. We thought ours was a lot more reasonable at 6 cents additional a mile, that it could raise about $400 million.
Now, what about this argument that the axles are what counts as far as the weight, and that the weight is distributed in a way that it doesn't really pound the roads as much as you would think? Is that an argument?
Well, I've heard that argument. That's why we kind of stayed away from axles and total weights, and we're doing based on just miles traveled for the two heaviest trucks. We thought we would keep it really simple and just go with that route. I've heard a lot of different things on the axles, but also there's the latest argument I heard about it too was it may not cause damage necessarily if the weight's distributed better, but once there is damage to the roads, then it causes more damage. So that's something that you want to look out for as well.
Do you feel like the House Democrats in general are in a better bargaining position with this particular issue when we're talking about road funding, because there is a revenue increase piece as part of that, and so the House Democrats would be conceivably counted on to support the number of votes that you need to get to 56? I mean, it's hard to imagine that you're going to get 56 Republicans supporting some kind of tax increase. So it seemed like House Democrats are in a position to really have an impact on the negotiations and something that you guys want as part of the final product.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the solution that involves additional revenue is automatically going to run up against some roadblocks in the Republican caucus. I mean, that's just, you know, when you sign pledges not to raise taxes, you're going to run into some of that. But what that does mean is both caucuses can come together and be a part of the solution. So, you know, even up in Mackinac, I brought it out that even at 45 cents, if the Republicans put up half the votes and we put up half the votes, we can make it happen. And really, I think that's what's best for the state in the long run, too, if we're both supporting the final solution and it's not one-sided. So we absolutely have a role in that. We've got 58-52 split right now, or 57-52, depending on how you look at it. And so we should be able to come together and find support from both caucuses.
So then what kind of a reaction have you gotten from Republicans to your latest version of a road plan?
You know, they've been pretty quiet, just like they have been on their road plan. we've heard from some constituency groups that are very supportive of it. Again, the business community is going to be more hesitant on it with the increase to the corporate income tax, but have not heard directly from the Republicans, because so far we haven't heard any new revenue being generated. We've just heard about shifting the sales tax and maybe trying to get some new revenue that way, but it would still be just no new revenue, though. So, yeah, I'm waiting.
You've been working on the budget bills, and the argument has been that there's the money in the budget. We just got to find it. Is it there?
Well, it must be buried really deep, because for 8 years they haven't been able to find it, right? So, I mean, we were under one-party control for 8 years straight. And you would think if there was any extra fat in the budget, it would have been come forth in the past. And the approach that the House Republicans took with the budget, with just cutting 25% across the board for IT projects and 3% for administration, that to me is just fiscally irresponsible and, frankly, lazy. If you're really saying there's some fat in there, then prove it where it is. And we haven't seen any evidence of that. Instead, we'll just take this wholesale amount across the top and not spending the time to say, what does that really mean? Does that mean we're going to have even more problems with our unemployment insurance, more problems with the systems that track kids in protective services, foster kids, systems that track how we spend our federal dollar matches, our roads project, things that keep people safe and make sure projects are done on time. Just to unilaterally say we're going to slash 25% of that just doesn't make any sense to me.
Did you find that the most frustrating part of the House Republicans' budget that they passed out, the 3% cut and the 25% cut to IT?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was finding, I think the amount that that supposedly generated was $500 million, and that kind of set some of their other processes in place. But you started step one on just an irresponsible process of that across the board. So you can make it sound like, oh, we're putting a little extra more money into the school aid fund or higher education will be back in the general fund. But when you set that in motion by doing this really across the board irresponsible cut, it doesn't make sense. It's very frustrating.
How many members of your caucus do you believe would vote yes on a 45-cent gas tax increase?
You know, we haven't whipped it yet. I'm not sure.
But just kind of a rough feeling from talking to people. You think you get half of your caucus members there, 20% of them?
I know I could get 100% that want to generate $2.5 billion.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know a caucus member that doesn't think that this is what the problem is that we're facing. So when we see all the different options, then I'll have a better feel for which components they would actually be supporting.
How do you gauge the public sentiment? Nobody wants to pay higher taxes. I can hear the response now. We get a Democratic governor, taxes go up. Mm-hmm. But what do you think the public sentiment is about a gas tax?
You know, in the many meetings I've been a part of, either leading or attending, what people really appreciate is having a governor who's the adult saying we can't put this problem off anymore. The governor actually came to Farmington Hills to meet with members of my community, and when she walked through the problem and if we don't address it now, how we're going to further erode our infrastructure, and that will cost us jobs down the road. Businesses won't want to come here. If we don't address the school part of that our kids are, more kids are being lost in the cracks, and they really appreciated that. And I know the members of my community afterwards shook their heads. Yeah, I get it. I get why we have to step up and pay more. But then the follow-up was, can't other groups pay more too? Can't we all do this? And to me, this is what a true Marshall Plan really is, right? It's rebuilding an infrastructure. If you look back after World War II, it's everyone coming together to solve this problem as a team. And that's why I wanted to put out these other ideas or caucus members of how we can engage more groups to get to that $2.5 billion.
So what groups are you talking about? What groups need to be included in this?
Business. That's the number one. I mean, we are trying to attract talent here in this state. We are trying to get people to move to the state. But if I have family members, for me in particular, coming here from Indiana and they drive on 8 Mile Road or stretches of 94 and it's just in total disrepair, what are we doing to attract more people to move to Michigan? And you have to start with good roads and strong communities, strong schools. And that's why the business community should care a lot about this. It's an investment in our quality of life, in our economy as well. And for them to come to the table and put some into it. For every 1% you raise the corporate income tax, you can generate $170 million at least in new revenue. So what are they comfortable with bringing to the table?
They didn't like your plan much. The chamber came out with a statement on Friday on this.
Well, sure. Whenever you're asking any particular group to put more out there and help out, but come to the table. I mean, just to say everyone, you know, pays 45 cents more and we have no direct responsibility for this, that's not really a team approach, I think. And this is about our economy in this state. We had, you know, Amazon that turned us down recently, too. And part of that was our transportation infrastructure and it was the talent. So what are we doing to try to remedy that to make sure we are attracting businesses? That means everyone needs to come to the table, and that includes business.
Just a couple more questions here, but how would you describe your relationship is now with Lee Chatfield? At one point during a House debate, you said that he'd lied to you. Have you guys been able to make amends on that?
Yeah, I mean, we meet every week and we talk, and then we also have our quadrant meetings as well. So, you know, I think we got across that initial hurdle of a little gap in communication, and I think we've been able to pick that back up and talk about the session agenda, the issues, and then also in our quadrant meetings, we have very productive discussions.
Have you guys been able to talk at all about the budget yet, as far as trying to find some common ground and working on a compromise?
Yeah, I think in detail, they haven't started yet. I think, you know, there's probably still a lot of conversations going on in individual caucuses, and then as soon as some of those get a little further, then we'll come together as leaders and talk about it.
Is it possible that this budget could have been done by July 4th? It's not going to be done by July 4th, and it may not even be done by the month of July or by the month of August. Do you think that that's a failure of anything in particular, or is that just the way the calendar just kind of broke down?
I think in a lot of ways it's how the calendar broke down. I mean, we did start with the governor's proposal later than normal. Then you throw in auto no fault and all of that as well. And you also throw in this incredibly big proposal for roads funding. So there's some big issues that were rolled in at either directly into the budget or at the same timeline as the budget. And so it's pretty understandable that we're not quite where we should be or where we have been in the past. But I think there's a real commitment, though, that we're not sitting here on September 30th waiting to pass a budget for October 1st.
What's the timetable for the summer? I mean, we kind of left session in a very odd way and just kind of ended and early. So what do you see as the timetable for the summer?
So I see a lot of work going on during the summer, but whether it requires all of us to come back here for session is still up in the air at this point. You know, I'm here today. There are a lot of members are here today, even though we tentatively broke at the end of last from session at the end of last week. But there's just a lot of work going on in smaller groups in Lansing over the summer. Now, so in my opinion, what will happen is if we actually get some resolution and agreement, then we'll come back sometime, you know, July or August to actually vote on a budget is my goal.
What do you think the odds are that we actually have a budget done by Labor Day? 25% chance? 30? 10% chance?
By Labor Day. So a month ahead of time. I'm going to be optimistic. I'm going to say a 60% chance.
60% chance. Wow, that would be really good.
And then It would. I mean, you got to remember, like, school budgets start July 1st.
Right.
So we're already not giving them the stability and the surety that they need at this point. So they're actually in the classroom right after Labor Day, too. So that should be the furthest goal, I would think, would be Labor Day.
And then the last question I want to ask you about is redistricting, because the Supreme Court is presumably at the federal level going to come down with some kind of ruling at some point this week, obviously before the end of the month. What do you hope happens in regards to redistricting?
Well, that's a really good question.
Yeah, what are you
rooting
for?
Because in some ways it's going to create a lot of chaos, right,
we
have to draw the lines. So, but I also know that if we end up redrawing the lines for 2020, it's going to favor the Democrats, and we can only gain from that. So I am really conflicted on this, but of course, you know what, I really want what the people want, and they want fairer lines, so I'm rooting that the Supreme Court ruling comes down that we have to redraw these lines, and if the legislature doesn't do it by August 1st, then we bring in a special master to get it done. I mean, yeah, it is going to be a little chaotic if we're redrawing House and Senate maps this term, 2 years earlier than we thought, but that is what the people want. They spoke loud and clear when we passed Proposal 2 with Voters Not Politicians in 2018. So if we actually make it happen sooner and not have to wait for the census, I think that's great. The only concern I have is, you know, it is complicated because it's based on 2010 census data too. So it's a pretty complicated process, but at the end of the day, if it's what the voters wanted and voted for, then I think we need to make it happen.
Christine Gregg, the House Minority Leader. Thanks for hosting us.
Yeah,
we appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming into my office.
All right. That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Ari for stopping by, Jack, Mike, Jacob, and Christine Gregg for taking some time with us. And Ari, I see you're able to squeeze into a spot in the parking lot over here. I'm surprised you were able to fit your little orange car in there.
I've never seen the parking lot so full at MERS World Headquarters. I thought there was something going on that I hadn't been invited to.
It's just our weekly planning meeting, that's all. But it just seems for some reason we have got an innate ability here at MERS to park in the parking lot in such a way that you could almost get a car into the next spot, but you really can't. And so you're kind of, if there's a way to get fewer cars in the parking lot at MERS, we have found a way to do it. We could probably fit 12 cars in there, but we find a way to only get 7.
I'm still stuck on the fact that you're having a planning meeting. I didn't know you guys did that here at MERS. I was just, MERS, we wing it.
Well, what would you say was worse parking-wise, MERS parking lot or the media parking space?
Ooh, now that's a good question. The media parking spot over by the Capitol, where you could get 5 cars, but you usually only get 3.
Yeah, you'd have to have somebody out there, you know, directing people to be able to get, you know, 5 in there. And then they'd be so close to each other that the ones in the middle wouldn't be able to move till the other ones on the ends move first.
Jack, you just need to get a driver like Scuba Cas.
No, that's a good idea.
Oh,
no, yeah, right. I made it very clear we need the Democrats to control the legislature, because I'm sure they would make a bigger parking space for all the reporters. Maybe, you know, get one lawmaker that could have their name on a sign, you know, the Senator Ananick media parking area or something.
Ooh,
like that.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and then you have also, I think, in the Senate, you would have maybe relaxed rules if the Dems were in control and more room behind the media space. I mean, whenever anybody's not in power, you can always think of all sorts of ways things would be better if they were.
Jack's campaign is going to be support the damn media.
That's right. Give us some parking spots. Let us drink your coffee. Let us use your bathrooms on the Senate floor. That's
by the way, as we found out, when the Senate does go to the House in July, which supposedly they're going to be actually in the House holding Senate hearings, or Senate sessions, I should say, we have found out it will make no difference because the Senate sergeants are going to be there, so we will not be able to go back and get coffee in the House chamber.
Oh, my God, that is a tragedy.
It is. It's worse than you actually know.
It could be, actually. And you got to wonder, though, are they discriminating against you, Jack? Because when the House comes in, Mike will be allowed to go in the back and get coffee and use the bathroom. But when the Senate is in, you won't be able to do it.
They have been discriminating against me my entire life. And that is the way I feel, just like every taxpayer feels that way. And it's just perfectly clear that it's utter, total discrimination. And yes, it is personal.
I maintain that it is in the best interest of the House that I actually stay awake while I'm on the floor. Therefore, I think it's fair that I drink the coffee.
I wonder if they just don't want you to drink the coffee on the Senate floor. Maybe it's that much better that once the reporters taste it, they'll never want to go to the House.
That makes no sense, because I was in the House when the coffee was so bad. I remember Dawson Bell, every time he'd see me drink it, he goes, "My God, that stuff's going to kill you." And then they actually upgraded it, and it's actually good. And they did that while I was there. So it can't be that they don't want me drinking coffee. I think they just finally figured out I'm better off if I'm not awake.
All right.
Or they're better off.
All right. Well, hopefully you all stayed awake and listened to this entire podcast. Thank you if you did. Thank you for listening. Thank you to AT&T for sponsoring. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malone. Take care.